Okay, let's unpack this. Think about those tasks that seem pretty simple on the surface, maybe mixing something up or applying a product in the yard or even just walking through a field that was treated recently. What if that job, the one that looks straightforward, actually has some hidden risks? What if there are specific rules, like non-negotiable rules and essential gear you absolutely have to have to protect yourself?
Yeah, that's really what we're digging into today. We've gone through the stack of sources you shared, and we're focusing specifically on what they say about personal protective equipment, PPE, and safety practices for working with pesticides. Our mission here is basically to pull out the key info, cut through all the jargon, and show you what's not just like good practice, but often legally required for staying safe, whether you're the one handling the stuff directly or just working nearby.
All right, so we're going to build this up, kind of like layers of safety. First, the foundation, the training you definitely need. Then we'll get into the actual gear, what those different protection levels mean, what goes on your body, from regular work clothes all the way up to specialized suits and respirators. After that, the part people might forget but is super important: how do you take care of that gear so it actually works?
And finally, we'll look at some pretty clever engineering solutions, things that protect you without you even having to wear them.
Exactly. It's all about turning that information from the sources into practical understanding for you.
Right, so let's start at square one. Who needs this training? And what's the basic requirement?
Okay, so according to your source, there are basically two main groups legally required to get safety training. First, you have pesticide handlers, that's anyone mixing, loading, applying, even flaggers. And second, early entry agricultural workers. Those are folks who go into a treated area before the restricted entry interval, the REI, is up.
REI, right. That's the waiting period on the label. Exactly. It's that specific time you have to wait before going back into a treated area without special protection. So both these groups, handlers and early entry workers, they have to follow the product label instructions and any California regulations that apply.
So the label's the minimum, but California might pile on more requirements. Is that it?
That's it, yeah. Your source points out that California rules often go, well, above and beyond what the label says. Think of it like this. You can always use more PPE or follow stricter rules than required. But you can never use less, never ignore what's mandated. You always have to follow the most protective rule that applies.
Got it. Makes sense. And this training, is it just a one and done thing?
No, it's actually an annual requirement that's under both federal and state laws. However, if you can show proof, like verification, that the training was done within the past year, you don't have to repeat it within that same year. And crucially, the training has to be in a language the employees fully understand. And the trainer. They need to be physically there for the whole session.
Okay, must be present.
Yeah.
And when does the training need to happen? Like before they start working with this stuff?
Yes, exactly. It's required before anyone handles pesticides, if they're a handler. And for field workers, it's before they enter that treated field during an REI. It's all about preventing exposure, right? So it has to happen before there's even a chance of exposure.
That makes complete sense.
Care.
Okay, the source lists specific topics for handler training. What are some of the key things covered there?
Oh, it covers a lot of practical stuff, directly related to using the product, like how to properly handle containers, opening them, lifting, pouring, how to operate the application equipment safely, learning how to triple rinse the empty containers and get rid of them the right way, keeping the pesticide in the application area, basically, and avoiding contaminating people, animals, water, sensitive areas. Also, what to do in emergencies, spills, leaks, fires. Proper storage, especially if you can't lock the containers up.
So practical skills plus emergency stuff.
Right. And just as important, understand the key documents. Reading and really getting labels and safety data sheets, SDSs, knowing what signal words mean, precautionary statements, first aid, application rates, all that. A big chunk of the training is about PPE, the personal protective equipment we'll talk more about, including why you need different types, when you need them, and how to properly fit them, wear them, check them, and maintain them. Respiratory protection, like respirators, gets special focus too, fitting, using, maintaining them.
Yeah, protecting your lungs seems like a really big deal here. What else is on that list?
They also train on using engineering controls. We'll get to those later, how to secure and transport pesticides safely, and understanding medical supervision requirements, and the employer's duty to provide that supervision if it's needed.
Okay, wow, that's a deep dive just for the handlers. What about general safety things that apply to everyone who might be exposed? Handlers and field workers.
Yeah, this part is more about personal habits, things you do to cut down your risk. It covers how important it is to wash your work clothes separately and daily, washing your hands really well before you eat, smoke, drink, or use the bathroom, and showering at the end of the workday.
Basic hygiene, but sounds like it makes a huge difference. And never taking pesticides or containers home, right?
It's absolutely critical. That's covered, and it's strictly forbidden.
Yeah.
Other topics are understanding SDSs, recognizing and staying out of restricted areas like those under an REI, and ways to reduce hazards for kids or pregnant women. A really key point is learning how pesticides can get into your body through your skin, your eyes, your lungs from breathing them in, and your mouth if swallowed.
Knowing the ways in helps you know how to block them, I guess.
Exactly. It also covers recognizing symptoms of overexposure and understanding the different kinds of health effects. Acute, that's immediate, like a rash or feeling sick right away. Chronic long-term effects from repeated exposure. Delayed stuff that shows up hours or days later. And sensitization, basically becoming allergic after being exposed multiple times. First aid and emergency decontamination procedures are obviously vital. Knowing where to find emergency medical info, company reporting policies, that's all in there. Plus, recognizing and avoiding heat illness, that's a big risk when you're working outside, especially wearing certain gear.
And workers' rights are part of this training too.
Yes, definitely. Empowering workers with that knowledge is key. So the training covers the relevant laws, why compliance matters, the minimum age, which is 18 to handle pesticides or do early entry work, your right to know about potential exposures, protection against retaliation if you report concerns, and how to report violations. They also learn how to get access to important documents, things like hazard communication plans, labels, PSIS sheets, that's Pesticide Safety Information Series, SDSs, and pesticide use records.
That is incredibly thorough. So, with all these rules, who's actually on the hook for providing the training and the gear? The employer.
Your source makes that crystal clear. It's the employer. They are legally responsible. They must provide all the required PPE and training, and it has to be at no cost to the employee. They can't make workers buy their own safety gear. The employer also has to make sure the equipment is easy to get to and that it's properly cleaned and maintained. That cleaning might be done by the employee following specific steps or maybe by a third-party service.
And the source even lists who can be a qualified trainer.
It does, yeah. Specifies people like pest control advisors, PCAs, certified applicators, registered foresters, UC farm advisors, certain county biologists, and people who've done a DPR-approved instructor course. DPR is the California Department of Pesticide Regulation, and employers have to keep records of all this training for 3 years.
Okay, so that covers the essential groundwork. The training, knowing the rules, responsibilities. Now, let's get physical, the actual gear. This personal protective equipment, PPE, what is it exactly?
Well, the source defines PPE pretty simply. It's any item you wear or use to put a barrier between your body and the pesticide. But the level of protection you get can vary a lot depending on what the item is made of.
And the source breaks down those protection levels.
It does. The top level mentioned is chemical resistant. That means basically no detectable amount of the pesticide can move through the material while you're using it. Then there's water resistant. That's designed to keep out small spray particles or splashes. And waterproof, or sometimes called liquid proof. This keeps out water-soluble stuff, but, and this is really important, waterproof doesn't necessarily protect against pesticides mixed with oil solvents. Waterproof gear is usually plastic or rubber.
Okay, that difference between waterproof and chemical resistant sounds critical.
It really is. You absolutely have to read the gear's packaging and the pesticide label carefully. You need to know what level of protection you're getting and if it's actually the right type for the specific pesticide you're handling.
What about just regular work clothes? Your source says they aren't technically PPE, but they're still required sometimes.
That's right. Your everyday shirt, pants, socks, closed-toe shoes. They aren't considered a chemical barrier like real PPE, but labels often do require minimum clothing. And California rules say employee handlers need at least a long-sleeve shirt, long pants, socks, and closed-toed shoes. Same goes for field workers going into areas with pesticide residue. The clothes should be sturdy, you know, no holes. Shirt collar fastened. The weave of the fabric matters a bit tighter, is slightly better than loose, but even tight weaves still absorb pesticides, maybe just a bit slower.
And there are materials you should generally just avoid for chemical resistance.
Yeah, the source specifically warns against relying on cotton, leather, canvas, or anything absorbent like that, even with dry pesticides. Those dry particles can get trapped in the fibers and just stay there. and definitely avoid cloth or leather sweatbands, and especially avoid gloves, boots, or aprons that have a cloth lining. Once those liners get contaminated, the source says they're practically impossible to clean properly, and usually they aren't disposable, so you end up holding the pesticide right against your skin. Ugh.
Yikes. Yeah, that really hammers home why absorbent stuff is risky. Okay, so actual chemical-resistant clothing. Coveralls seem pretty standard.
They are. Chemical-resistant coveralls are usually worn over your normal work clothes, your shirt, pants, socks. They need to cover your whole body except your hands, feet, and head. If it's a two-piece outfit, the jacket part has to overlap the pants by a good amount, well below the waist, so there's no gap. Common materials mentioned are things like Tyvek or laminated Tyvek. But the protection isn't just the fabric, it's also the design. Like having flaps over zippers, elastic at the wrists and ankles, maybe sealed seams, all to stop pesticides getting in.
And there's a specific point about how they should fit, not tight.
Exactly. Crucially, they should fit loosely. This creates a little layer of air between the coverall, your clothes, and your skin. And that air layer actually adds a bit more protection. If they're tight, you lose that air gap.
What about chemical-resistant suits? The source says those are for the really hazardous stuff.
Yeah, those offer much higher protection, required for pesticides that can cause severe acute or chronic health problems. They need extra care when you wear them and clean them. But a major drawback is heat. They trap a lot of body heat.
Oh, my bad. Makes sense. The source mentions temperature limits.
It does. If the label requires a chemical-resistant suit, you generally can't handle that pesticide if it's hotter than 80 degrees Fahrenheit during the day or 85 degrees Fahrenheit at night.
Are there ways around those temperature limits? Exceptions.
Yes. You can get around the restriction if you're applying from inside an air-conditioned enclosed cab, or if you're wearing some kind of body cooling duvels under the suit, like an ice vest. But regardless of the temperature, the source really stresses taking extra steps to avoid heat illness. Drink lots of water, take frequent breaks, you know the drill.
Aprons are also listed under chemical-resistant gear.
Right. Aprons mostly protect your front, your clothes from splashes, spills, dust, especially when you're mixing, loading, or cleaning your application equipment. The label might require one, but the source suggests it's probably a good idea to wear one anytime you're handling pesticide concentrates, even if the label doesn't specifically say so for that task.
What makes a good apron for this?
The source recommends one that's long enough to cover you from your neck down to at least your knees. Some even come with sleeves and gloves attached, which is great for closing potential gaps. A wider bib gives better chest protection. There's a safety note too. Be careful wearing aprons around moving machine parts, like a PTO shaft on a tractor power takeoff shaft. They could get tangled. In those situations, a full suit might actually be safer. And obviously, toss the apron if it gets torn.
Okay, let's talk gloves. The source gives some pretty powerful reasons why gloves are so vital.
Yeah, this is a huge exposure point. Research mentioned in your source shows that for mixers, something like 85% of their total skin exposure happens on their hands, and another 13% on the forearms. So hands and forearms together, that's almost all the skin exposure right there. But the good news is wearing chemical-resistant gloves can cut that exposure down by an incredible 99%.
Wow, 99%. Just hearing that statistic makes you realize how critical gloves are. And California specifically requires them for mixing and loading.
Yes. California rules say employee handlers must wear chemical-resistant gloves when they mix or load any pesticide. Doesn't matter what the label says for that specific activity, and the employer has to provide them.
What kind of materials are we talking about for these gloves?
Okay, the source lists several good options. Natural rubber, barrier laminate, butyl rubber, nitrile rubber, polyethylene, PVC, that's polyvinyl chloride vitin, and neoprene rubber. Definitely avoid leather or fabric gloves unless the label specifically says to use them, which is pretty rare for most pesticides. Generally, thicker gloves give more protection, resist punctures better. California usually requires at least 14 mils thick for most chemical-resistant gloves. A mil is tiny, 1/1000th of an inch. The source also mentions using something like a DPR glove key code chart to help pick the right material for the specific chemical you're using.
And lined gloves are a definite problem.
Big problem, yeah. The source says use only unlined chemical-resistant gloves. Those fabric liners just soak up pesticides and hold them right next to your skin. Very dangerous, hard to clean. Now, you can use separate woven liners inside for warmth or sweat absorption, but only if the pesticide label doesn't forbid it. And those liners cannot stick out past the cuff of the chemical-resistant glove. Plus, California rules say you can't wash or reuse those liners. Discard them daily or right away if they get contaminated.
How should the gloves fit? And how do they work with your sleeves?
They should come up to about your mid-forearm. Usually you wear your shirt sleeves outside the gloves. That stops pesticides from running down your arm and getting inside the glove. The main exception is if you're spraying liquid straight up overhead. In that specific case, you'd tuck the sleeve of the arm that's up inside the glove cuff. But you have to be really careful when you lower your arm so the liquid doesn't run in then. Point is, no gaps between the glove and sleeve. Clothes with elastic wrists can help keep that seal tight.
Moving up the body, eye protection.
Right. Eye protection is mandatory if the pesticide label says so. But again, California adds an extra layer. Employee handlers mixing or loading pesticides must wear eye protection and gloves, even if the label doesn't specifically require eye protection for that product or task.
What counts as eye protection? Glasses. Goggles.
The source lists things like goggles, face shields, or safety glasses that have side shields.
And there's a special requirement for eyewash, too.
Yes, this is really important. If the label requires any eye protection, the handler has to have at least 1 pint of clean water or eyewash immediately accessible, like right on their person or in the cab or aircraft they're in. And even more, if you're mixing or loading and you're required to wear eye protection, or if you're using a closed mixing system, then a full eyewash station has to be located right there at the mix load site for immediate flushing if something splashes.
Protecting your lungs with respirators. That sounds like it has the most complex requirements.
It does, and for good reason. Your respiratory tract absorbs chemicals much faster than your skin. It's a very quick way for pesticides to get into your bloodstream. So if a respirator is required by the label, regulations, company policy, maybe a permit condition, then employee handlers must get medically cleared by a doctor before they're even allowed to wear one.
A medical clearance just to wear a respirator. Wow, that really underlines how serious this is.
It really does. Wearing a respirator can put extra strain on your body, especially your heart and lungs. The medical check just makes sure you're healthy enough to handle that safely. And beyond the medical part, if respirators are required, the employer has to set up and run a written respiratory protection program. This program is pretty comprehensive. It needs an administrator, procedures for picking the right respirator, medical evaluations, fit testing, rules for proper use routine and emergency use cleaning and maintenance procedures, annual training, ways to check if the program's working, and an annual review of the whole thing.
Fit testing and facial hair sound like major factors for respirators.
Absolutely critical, especially for tight-fitting ones. The respirator has to make a tight seal against your face. If it doesn't, contaminated air just leaks in around the edges. Facial hair usually prevents that seal. So, regulations say people with facial hair that interferes with the seal can't use tight-fitting respirators. Simple as that. And all tight-fitting respirators have to be fit tested to the specific person wearing it before they use it the first time, and then usually every year after that. That testing has to be done by someone trained to do it to make sure you can actually get a good seal. And of course, the respirator itself needs to be kept in good shape and cleaned daily.
Okay, so we've covered the training, the different kinds of gear, when you need it. But all that PPE is only good if it's clean and working properly, right?
That's a huge point your source makes. PPE is only effective if it's clean and maintained. You have to inspect it regularly. If anything's damaged or worn out, it needs to be replaced or fixed right away.
What's the first thing you should do if your PPE gets pesticide on it?
Okay, the source outlines the steps. First, get the contaminated PPE off immediately, but the order matters. Start by washing the outside of your gloves really well with soap and water while you're still wearing them. Then, before you take the gloves off, wash the outside of your other chemical-resistant gear. That way, you avoid touching the contaminated surfaces with your bare hands when you take everything off. If your clothes underneath got hit too, change those as well.
How do you actually clean chemical-resistant clothing? Like coveralls.
First rule, don't rewear it until it's washed, and wash it daily if you used it. Now, if the clothing gets totally soaked with a concentrated or highly toxic pesticide, you usually can't wash it clean. It has to be disposed of properly at a place that handles pesticide waste, but lightly or moderately contaminated clothing, that can usually be washed. And disposable clothing, well, that just gets thrown out daily.
The source has a really detailed washing procedure, almost like a recipe in that sidebar.
Right. It does, yeah. Sidebar 7-2A. Key steps are, keep the contaminated clothes separate from all other laundry. Always. Wear rubber gloves when you handle them. Wash only small loads, and this is important. Wash clothes contaminated with different pesticides in totally separate loads. Avoids cross-contamination. Pre-soaking can help, but it's optional. For machine washing, Use the hottest water the fabric can handle, set the water level to full, use a normal cycle at least 12 minutes, and use the maximum amount of liquid laundry detergent the machine suggests. Liquid is generally better than powder for getting oil-based pesticides out of fibers.
And definitely no bleach or ammonia.
Sora says absolutely never use bleach or ammonia. They don't really remove most pesticides anyway, and worse, they can react with some residues and create toxic fumes right there in your laundry area. Not good. If the clothes still smell or have stains after one wash, wash them again. And after you're done washing the contaminated load, run the machine empty just with detergent and hot water to clean the washer itself out. Then air dry the clothes outside if you can. Avoids potentially contaminating your dryer.
And what about that heavily contaminated stuff that just can't be washed?
Right, that has to be destroyed. Basically, take it to an approved disposal site for hazardous waste or pesticide residues. The sidebar also gives some good tips to keep your family safe, like using disposable PPE when you can, always wearing all the required PPE, wearing clean stuff daily, taking contaminated gear off at the worksite and bagging it there, and changing immediately if you spill concentrate on yourself.
How about cleaning specific things like boots and gloves?
For boots and gloves, again, wash the outside under running water before you take them off. Once they're off, clean them daily. Soap, warm water, soft brush. Rinse really well. Try not to get the insides wet. Check them for holes or damage while you're washing. If you find any, throw them out. Interestingly, the source mentions you can actually machine wash chemical-resistant gloves. Put them in a mesh bag, wash them separately from other laundry, use warm water, follow the same basic steps as washing clothes. After washing, turn the gloves inside out to help them dry completely. Store them dry, maybe in plastic bags. And just to repeat, those removable glove liners cannot be washed or reused. Discard daily or if they get contaminated.
Face shields and goggles need daily washing too.
Yep, wash daily. You have to be careful not to scratch the plastic lenses, though. Submerge them in warm, soapy water. Use a soft, wet cloth or brush. The source specifically says don't rub lenses if they have an anti-fog coating. It can damage it. Rinse them well. Let them air dry or gently blot with a soft cotton cloth again, no rubbing. Inspect them for scratches, cracks. Check the headband elasticity. Replace scratched lenses if you can. Store them in something like a paper bag to keep them clean.
Respirators seem like they need the most careful attention.
They absolutely do. It's critical gear. Inspection is actually twice daily, before the first use of the day, and again before you clean it at the end of the day. Check everything. Headbands, filters, gaskets, the valve parts like the flaps and seats, the face piece itself. Look for wear, cracks, dirt, damage. Any damaged part has to be replaced with an approved part for that specific brand and model. Can't mix and match parts. And any respirators kept for emergency use or as backups need to be inspected monthly.
And cleaning the respirator itself after use.
Okay, so after you take out the filters or cartridges from a reusable one, you soak the face piece, gaskets, valve parts in warm water with a mild liquid detergent. The source really emphasizes mild detergent. No harsh stuff like abrasives, alcohol, or solvents. If the respirator is shared between people, you'd also use a sanitizer recommended by the maker. Use a soft brush or cloth. Rinse everything really well with clean water and let all the parts air dry completely. Keep them out of direct sun or heat while drying.
What about the filters and cartridges themselves?
Okay, reusable filters and cartridges are one thing, but for the removable disposable cartridges and pre-filters, the source is adamant. Discard them at the end of each work period. Doesn't matter if you only wear the respirator for 10 minutes, they start absorbing stuff from the air as soon as they're exposed. And those one-time use disposable cartridge respirators, it can't be cleaned at all. You just dispose of the whole thing according to the manufacturer's instructions and local rules.
What if you just take a reusable respirator off for a quick break, but aren't cleaning it right then?
Good question. The source says wipe down the body and face piece. If the cartridges or canisters have caps or covers, put those back on. Then, and this is important, seal the whole respirator in an airtight container, like a good quality zip-top bag. This stops the disposable parts, the filters and cartridges, from just sitting there, absorbing more impurities from the air while you're not wearing it, helps them last longer during the work period.
The source also mentions what happens if someone else is cleaning the PPE, not the person who wore it.
Right. Anyone cleaning contaminated PPE needs to know the hazards they're dealing with. They should protect themselves too. Wear gloves, maybe an apron, work in a well-ventilated spot if possible. Avoid breathing in steam from hot washing. They should follow the PPE manufacturer's cleaning instructions if available, or use the general procedure from sidebar 72B. Small loads, heavy-duty liquid detergent, hot water, longest cycle, 2 rinses. Maybe 2 full wash cycles if it's moderately or heavily contaminated. Clean the washer afterwards. And dispose of anything too contaminated to clean at a proper hazardous waste site. The source also suggests washing things like gloves, boots, coveralls inside and out if you can. Rigid things like boots or hard hats can be hand washed with hot water and heavy-duty liquid detergent.
Where should you keep clean PPE once it's ready to go?
Store it in a clean, dry place. Keep it away from extreme temperatures and bright sunlight, because those can degrade the materials over time. Using sealable plastic bags is a good idea, helps protect from light, heat, dirt, air pollution. And here's a huge rule. Never store your clean PPE in the same place where you store pesticides. Keep them completely separate. Now, after all that about gear and cleaning, it's really vital we touch on the source's point about limitations.
Right, that's key, isn't it? PPE isn't like a magic shield.
Exactly. It's only one piece of the safety puzzle. It never gives you complete 100% protection. It's a barrier, yes, but you still have to do everything possible to prevent spills, splashes, and sprays from even happening. The gear reduces your exposure if something goes wrong, but stopping it before it gets to your gear. That's the main goal. Prevention first.
And what if pesticides do get trapped underneath the PPE somehow?
Yeah, the source explains that's a bad situation. If pesticides get trapped under your chemical-resistant gear, they can't evaporate away. And if the clothes you have on underneath are also contaminated, trapping that pesticide against your skin with the PPE layer can actually increase how much gets absorbed into your body. That's why you always, always wear clean PPE over clean clothing. The source also throws in a safety warning about loose-fitting PPE potentially getting caught in moving machinery, like that PTO shaft. So you got to be aware of those hazards, too.
Okay, so we've hit the crucial training, the different gear types, how vital proper care is, and the big reminder that prevention is still king, even with the best gear. The source also talks about another layer of protection, engineering controls. These aren't things you actually wear, right?
That's right. Engineering controls are protective devices or systems that are kind of built into the equipment or the process itself. They protect handlers during mixing, loading, or application, but they aren't worn on the body. Employers have to provide these if the label or regulations require them.
But they are still considered a type of PPE.
Yes, your source lumps them in with PPE. And there's an important rule. Anytime you step outside the protection of one of these controls, like getting out of an enclosed cab, you must put on all the required traditional PPE. That traditional gear should be kept right there, handy, maybe in a chemical-resistant container, so you can put it on immediately upon exiting the control.
What are the main kinds of engineering controls the source mentions?
Well, a common one is enclosed cabs on tractors or other application machines. These cabs protect the operator from spray droplets and mists. Some are even air conditioned, which really helps with heat stress. But enclosed cabs do not automatically replace the need for respiratory protection if the label requires it. The only exception is if the required respirator is just a basic filtering face piece, like a dust mask. If the label requires a half face or full face respirator, you still have to wear that respirator even when you're inside the enclosed cab.
Ah, okay. That's a critical distinction. The cab doesn't cancel out all respirator requirements?
Not for the more protective types, no. Another major category is closed mixing systems. These are specific setups required for mixing, loading, diluting, or transferring certain liquid pesticides, usually the ones with strong hazard warnings on the label. These systems are designed to measure and move the pesticide concentrate safely and accurately, drastically cutting down the handler's exposure risk during that high-risk mixing loading phase.
And the source mentioned different tiers of these closed systems, based on how hazardous the pesticide is.
It did, yeah. Tier 1 and Tier 2. A Tier 1 system is the most protective. It not only removes the pesticide from its original container, but also rinses the empty container automatically while it's still connected. These are typically required for liquids with really serious warnings, like fatal if absorbed through the skin. A Tier 2 system removes the pesticide but doesn't have the automatic container rinsing feature built in. These are required for liquids with warnings like maybe fatal if absorbed through the skin, or corrosive, causes skin damage, still serious hazards, but maybe slightly less acutely dangerous than the Tier 1 products.
So the specific warning phrase on the label dictates which tier of closed system you need.
Exactly. The source does note that not every single pesticide handling situation requires a closed system. You need to check the specific regulations, like on the DPR website or in documents like that PSIS A3 sheet mentioned, to know exactly when they're mandatory.
And the last type of engineering control mentioned was actually part of the pesticide packaging.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of clever. Certain special packaging designs count as engineering controls because they inherently reduce your exposure to the concentrated product. The main example given is those pre-measured water-soluble bags or packets. You just drop the whole packet into the spray tank, the bag dissolves, and the pesticide mixes in. You never have to actually open a container, pour, or measure liquids or powders. It really cuts down the risk of spills or inhaling dust. And according to the regulations, using this kind of packaging is considered equivalent to using a closed mixing system.
Huh. That's a smart way to build the safety right into the product itself.
It really is a practical solution.
So let's try to wrap this deep dive up. We've walked through the essential safety training, looked at all the different layers of personal protective equipment from basic clothes right up to suits and respirators. We talked about how crucial it is to actually take care of that gear, and even explore these engineering controls like cabs and closed systems that add another safety layer.
Yeah, and the whole goal here, pulling straight from the source material you gave us, is really to paint a clear picture for you of this multi-layered approach to pesticide safety. It's about knowing the rules, understanding the tools, the PPE, and really getting that staying safe is an active thing. It takes training, the right equipment, and just careful practice day in and day out.
And the sources really hammer home that critical point. PPE isn't magic. It has limits.
Yeah.
It's a barrier, sure, but it doesn't totally eliminate risk. You still have to focus hard on preventing spills, preventing exposure in the first place. So knowing all of that, the rules, the gear, how to care for it, the engineering controls, and that absolute need for prevention, how does understanding that whole picture maybe fundamentally change how you approach safety?
Well, it shifts your mindset, doesn't it? It goes beyond just thinking, okay, got to put on my gloves and goggles. It moves towards really understanding that the gear is, in a way, the last line of defense. Your first strategy should be mastering the task, being super careful in handling an application, using everything you learned in training to minimize the chance of needing that barrier at all. It kind of raises a question for you to think about. Are you just checking boxes by wearing the gear, or are you truly integrating every single layer of safety knowledge into a genuinely preventative way of working?